and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C. Sierra Leone presidential contestants sign a peace pledge ahead of the coming June 24 general election.
We are the organized 22 by-election. For the very first time in the history of Sierra Leone, we are unable to, you know, count to by-election results, or neither those results we are not challenged.
A Nigerian group calls for the participation of women in security and defense institutions.
Many women have been victims of the insecurity in the country, and they are not being involved, you know, in terms of safety and protection.
And the African Development Bank Group's annual meeting ends in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh Friday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Sierra Leone, incumbent President Julius Maada Bio, main rival Samora Camara, and other presidential candidates signed a peace pledge, a move to help ensure the coming June 24 general election remains peaceful. Analysts say the agreement, which was signed at the Bintoumani International Conference Center in the capital Freetown, was a necessary signal to supporters of the candidates not to engage in violence during the election process. They also say it will help ease rising political tensions leading up to the elections. President Bio from the governing Sierra Leone People's Party, SLPP, is expected to face stiff competition from former foreign minister and main opposition leader Camara from the opposition All People's Congress, or APC. Abdul Fatoma is the executive director for Campaign for Human Rights and Development International. He talks to me about the significance of the peace accord and what else can be done to ease tension during the electoral process.
This is very significant because, Peter, we have having a lot of tensions around the upcoming elections since immediately after the previous election, 2018, the by-election in 2019, were tensions. And that is where we came in 2020, you know, to work with the electoral commissions to help them organize peaceful by-elections in communities up to 2022, where they organized 22 by-elections. For the very first time in the history of Sierra Leone, we are unable to, you know, count to by-elections results, or neither those results we are not challenged. So building up to the 2022 elections, a lot of tensions around socio-economic issues, human rights issues. And so it was definitely a great idea, you know, for the two major political party presidential candidates actually to sign this pledge in front of Sierra Leoneans and also our development partners.
Well, Abdul, some Sierra Leoneans have expressed concern, especially with some of the skirmishes between supporters of the governing party and the main opposition party. Why has this been so?
Well, basically, this is not a new phenomenon when it comes to our country politics. Since we return back to multi-party democracy, you know, the ruling party and the opposition, whether it's the SFPP or the APC in the ruling or in the oppositions, we always have these high tensions. But it's getting more tenser and tense, you know, to a point that, you know, our people are really suffocated and frustrated with the current political atmosphere in our country. We are now seeing ourselves deeply divided, either by a regional bloc or a tribal bloc, you know, when it comes to politics.
Well, I understand Paramount Chiefs hailed the move, but how are Sierra Leoneans reacting to the signing of this pledge?
This is not the first time we're having politicians actually signing pledges. We saw that in 2018, then there was also violence during our elections. And immediately after the 2018 elections, a peace committee was set up, comprises of both the main opposition members and also the ruling party members. They were asked to go into an investigation, what actually triggered, you know, the election violence and the post-election violence. And then both political parties failed to share with the general public the outcome of those reports. And coming back to the paramount chiefs, these people are supposed by our traditions and law to serve as the custodians of our local communities. And they are banned not to get a direct involvement with politics. But we have been seeing them over the years, not only this time around, previously. I mean, making a clear declaration for a political party or a political party candidate as their own choice. And that really scared the other, you know, opponent of that very candidate that they have endorsed openly, for them not to go into those communities because those paramount chiefs have authority, you know, over their subjects in those communities.
The pledge is supposed to reinforce existing national efforts towards peaceful election processes, national cohesion, like you said, and a stable political environment within the country. But do you see this happening?
Yes. What we are looking forward to as a country, we want actually, you know, the outcome of this signing of the peace pledge to be sustainable. But we are also skeptical about, you know, the sustainability of this based on the commitment of political parties. What the leaders will sign or share in the room is quite different what their supporters will do on the ground. So currently, we are in a campaign month. Campaigns are going around the country, you know, but we are still getting reports of political violence, political intimidations. So we hope that the signing of this peace pledge today will actually trickle down to our different communities across the country, because our engagement with the communities, like the market women, persons with disabilities, one of the great things we take from them is that they want to witness a peaceful elections come 2023 June.
Abdul Fatoma is the Executive Director for Campaign for Human Rights and Development International. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. In Senegal, former Prime Minister Idrissa Seck says if elected, he will implement measures to improve the living conditions of citizens. Seck, who is a founder and presidential candidate for the opposition Remy Party, which means nation in the local Wolof language, says he has the track record and the qualifications to bring change. His remarks come after he signed an agreement with Vanguard Africa, a human rights advocate based in Washington, D.C. Seck is also calling on the U.S. to help ensure peace and stability in Senegal following unconfirmed reports that President Macky Sall may seek an unprecedented third term in office. Voters in Senegal will go to the polls in February 2024 to choose a new president. I caught up with the former Senegalese prime minister and aspiring presidential candidate to talk about his electoral prospects, why he engaged human rights advocate Vanguard Africa, as well as his call for the U.S. to help shore up democracy in Senegal.
Vanguard Africa has an unparalleled track record of supporting ethical candidates who stand up for free and fair elections in Africa. We must work together to ensure that Senegal's rich, well-earned democratic tradition continues, and I have been recommended to work with Vanguard on that regard.
Talk to me about what critically it's at stake in the February 2024 election in Senegal. And what do you think are the key issues, or what are Senegalese telling you about the key issues they care about?
Well, we are at an inflection point for our country and our sub-region and the whole African continent. The main issue in Senegal is which candidate is best suited and qualified to provide people with more and better jobs, more income, more and better food, good health care, good education for their kids, Those are the main issues at stake in this upcoming election.
Well, so who do you think is best or uniquely qualified to meet the requirement of Senegalese, especially since supporters of the president, Macky Sall, are saying he has done all these that you talked about?
Two names come out of the pile. Myself, of course, and President Macky Sall. The only difference is that President Macky Sall has done a great job in providing those things I talked about. He could do better on the governance issue and other subjects, immaterial subjects. But the difference is that he cannot run for a third term because our constitution that we, the people of Senegal, have decided to modify last 2016 to provide that nobody can serve more than two terms.
But Mr. Seck, there are suggestions that he could seek another term in office. That is the third term that he said the constitution prevents him from doing so.
Yes, I have known President Sall for a long time. He served as minister under my prime ministership. And I take him at his word when he says he has not decided whether to stand for a third term yet. Myself, I have been extremely clear on the subject because a third term would lead to social turmoil, violence, and civil unrest. So I expect him to be wise enough not to announce that. But for the time being, no one has heard him say he will run for a third term. And I believe and pray that he doesn't.
Looking at your candidacy, what are your chances of winning the election?
Well, for me, anybody should and could run. It's only the Senegalese citizen and voter who has the right to decide who he is giving his vote to. And whatever the candidate, I believe I'm the best in providing the things I just mentioned. All my career, both in the private sector, from my PricewaterhouseCoopers background to my prime ministership, has proven that I'm the best qualified to provide those things to my country. And if the Senegalese people decide so, I will prove that in less than 5 years.
Idrissa Seck is a former Senegalese prime minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Dakar. In Nigeria, the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC, is calling for the participation of women in security and defense institutions. The NGO also called on the organizations and other stakeholders to ensure transparency and accountability. CISLAC says a review of the recruitment process for the various security organizations could help encourage the inclusion of women. The call came during a one-day workshop on reforming the country's defense and security sector through strengthening mechanisms that provide effective oversight. Awal Musa is the executive director for the group called the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC. He tells me that security organizations can also enhance their intelligence gathering process by engaging women in areas where militant groups operate in the effort to combat terrorism.
Many women have been victims of the insecurity in the country, and they are not being involved, you know, in terms of safety and protection, and they are not given any role even in terms of consultation that they could provide some useful information and strategy to overcome the various challenges that we are facing in the country as regard to the insecurity in Nigeria. That is why we thought that as a way of being inclusive, there's need to allow women to participate and to provide useful information and also to be consulted in the design of security architecture in the country.
What do you say to those who are saying sometimes women see the security sector as a no-go area? They see that as a job for the men and not necessarily for the women.
That is the reason why we think that once there's a level playing ground for everyone, including women, women will be definitely interested to participate and contribute in reducing the level of insecurity in this country. But when you make the entry difficult, you know, the recruitment generally, it is directly and indirectly, you know, making it difficult for them to be part and parcel of it. Otherwise, a lot of women are interested in, you know, contributing to the safety and protection of fellow Nigerians.
Awal, are you saying that the supposed or alleged lack of transparency and accountability in the security sector is an inhibitor or prevents women from joining the security sector? What else can be done to smoothen the process?
Absolutely. This is what we have observed, that lack of transparency and accountability in the recruitment process is one of the major, you know, challenges that, you know, excluded women from being part of this process. Secondly, we have also seen the fact that the incentives, you know, for not only women, but even the men and women to come into the security sector is also, you know, becoming a very challenging, you know, a situation whereby you have qualified, and because of certain, you know, sentiment, either gender or ethnic or religious or geographical consideration, you have been deprived from, you know, coming in. I think, you know, a lot needs to be done to change the way and manner in which we do recruitment in the security sector, because a lot of crooks and criminals, they find themselves in the security sector and making it difficult for even the insecurity to be dealt with. Because when you hire and recruited people who are paid to be there, which means that criminals can sponsor, you know, criminals to go and be recruited so that they can be giving them information. And it will, therefore, it will be difficult for us as a nation to successfully deal with insecurity, because they have spy. The criminal have planted spies within the security sector. And this is the reason why you see this kind of challenges of not being able to deal with the insecurity in the country. You know, as a condition for recruitment, then definitely those crooks and criminals will find their way into the security sector. And when they came in, since they paid their way to come in, whatever budgetary allocation, they will definitely divert it instead of using it to ensure that, you know, systems, infrastructure, equipment, facilities are actually, you know, provided. And then lastly, also a situation whereby people who have been serving in the security sector, they are due for promotion for 10 years, and you repeat to promote them. You know, it's also, you know, bringing lack of interest for people to join the security sector. Or somebody may have died, and for his wife or his, you know, children to get his benefit, you also suffer delay and also unnecessary extortion before you get, you know, your long one entitlement. So in order to sanitize the process, we need to make sure that we create zero security sector reform that will enable, you know, more transparency and accountability in the process, and that will also motivate and encourage women to really show interest and to really participate, because we have a lot of, you know, women with the capacity that if they are given the chance, they can help to reduce the level of insecurity through their inclusion into the security sector.
Awal Musa is the executive director for the group called the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, or CISLAC. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Has social media improved your life, or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code plus 1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, plus 1-202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
The African Development Bank Group's annual meeting ended in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh Friday. Organizers say the high-level meeting presented a unique opportunity for knowledge sharing among senior officials and government representatives, development agencies, NGOs, civil society, and the private sector. The theme for this year's meeting was mobilizing private sector financing for climate and green growth in Africa. Zambia's Finance Minister Dr. Sitombeko Mosokotwane was at the meeting. I reached him via Skype shortly following his discussion with his counterpart from the Democratic Republic of Congo about a joint Zambia DRC project to produce lithium batteries and improve the value chain. Some of the issues in our conversation included the development of public-private partnership, youth and women empowerment, as well as the collaborative plans between the African Development Bank and the Zambia government for development.
Indeed, we've just met with our colleagues from Congo DRC, the African Development Bank, and Zambia. You remember we agreed that the two countries work together to produce the batteries that are required so much for the world green economy. We met because we wanted to review on what is happening to advance this idea forward. And at the moment, feasibility studies are being undertaken to look at the various possibilities of how we can do this and all the necessary ingredients to make it done. We expect that feasibility study to be complete by the end of the year or before the end of the year, and that will determine the timeline of the next course of actions and milestones that will be required to push the idea forward.
Talk to me about development through the PPP. How is Zambia going to do this to create jobs, particularly for the youth?
We are already implementing PPP projects in Zambia. So far, we've signed 3 PPP projects. The biggest one of them is the one linking Lusaka, the capital city, to Ndola, which is about 350 kilometers away in the Copper Belt area. That we've signed, and we expect this year the works to start around August. And as you can imagine, you were asking questions about jobs. There'll be thousands of jobs on this project. There's another one also somewhere near the Congolese border from a town called Chingola to another one called Kasumbalesa. That is also under the way.
I've heard a lot of Zambians complain about inflation. They've talked about the price of the millimeal, which is a staple food. How is the government handling the issue of agricultural development in order to feed the people of Zambia?
Actually, Zambia has been self-sufficient in food terms. However, we are facing a situation now because a number of the neighboring countries, they are not self-sufficient for various reasons, and they've been buying lots of maize and maize meal from Zambia. Because of that extra demand coming from neighboring countries, the prices of this basic foodstuff has gone up. To deal with that, starting this year, we are going to encourage more investments into the agriculture sector. We are actually going to go out of Zambia to look for extra investors to come into Zambia to grow the grain so that our local people, especially the small farmers who grow enough to feed us, they can concentrate on that. But the outsiders who may operate at larger levels of technology and scale, they can then quickly get into the production of maize that will be enough to be able to supply to the rest of the region. So in short, the answer to your question, how are we dealing with the issue of the maize prices? We are encouraging bigger production of this crop to complement what we do already, and that is going to see the prices coming down.
Now, Mr. Finance Minister, talk to me about the enterprise development through SMEs and how that could help empower women and the youth in Zambia.
We already have a number of schemes for empowering women and the youth in Zambia. There's what you've mentioned, but on top of that, through the Ministry of Youth, there is an empowerment fund that is being distributed to the youth. Through the Ministry of Community Development, women are being supported. And also through the constituencies, the parliamentary constituencies, each one of us members of parliament in Zambia, there is an amount of money that is available to us. And with that money, we are able to give grants and also loans to the youth and the women in our constituencies. And that is running right now as we speak. And I think it's doing fairly well.
Dr. Setumbeko Mosokotwane is Zambia's finance minister. He spoke with me via Skype from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Uganda's parliament has launched an inquiry into expired academic and professional programs allegedly being taught at private and public universities and other tertiary institutions. This after some parliamentarians accused the authorities in charge of education of negligence. Local media reported this week that Ugandan students seeking to further their education abroad are being rejected because the courses they studied were not accredited. The National Council for Higher Education is the only constitutionally mandated body that accredits programs taught in universities and other tertiary institutions in Uganda. Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is a teacher and the minority leader in the Ugandan parliament. He tells me that his support calls for those responsible for failing to manage properly the accreditation process to be held accountable.
The world was shocked by the whole idea of a qualification being deemed expired. And that alone formed the discomfort of parliament and the rest of the country. Because under the laws of the land, academic programs approved by the National Council for Education is a government body charged with accrediting and updating and approving taught academic programs. They are supposed to update them every after 5 years. They're supposed to undergo review to make sure that they meet the required standards and therefore require of all licensed tertiary institutions and universities to continuously update their academic programs. But for you to deem this as expired was most discomforting, and it's an act of negligence on the part of the authority, the National Council, and the universities so concerned, and which is why, as legislators, we are interested in establishing the center of negligence.
Why would universities be teaching degrees that are not accredited? Why did we go on for so long?
You know, part of the way the system works is that once 5 years lapse, a program is not rendered expired. The program review is a process, not an event. And the regulations are such that you need the things teaching it. You know, accreditation being a process, updating is a process, and therefore, I am discarding. That's why some of us are discarding the whole idea of expiry. The regulations do not say you stop teaching, you review, or you revisit. It is this revisitation that really must be the issue, not that you are told to stop immediately under different training regime. Some are using a term system, others use a modular system. And therefore, it's a question of synchronization. And therefore, which is why we're discussing negligence of duty, not necessarily expiry of academic programs. I think the nomenclature for me is faulty, and it simply renders the whole idea of accreditation redundant. programs don't necessarily expire, but the update must, as of necessity, take place before even the time for application expires.
Well, Matthias, some people are suggesting that somebody or some people should be held accountable because they obviously dropped the ball and did not follow due process, some argue. What is your take as a lawyer and a prominent member of the Ugandan Parliament?
You know, Peter, I'm not only a lawyer, but I'm also a teacher, a professional teacher as such. That's why I can authoritatively speak about the subject matter. I agree entirely in holding certain people accountable for any negligence and abdication of responsibility. And this should be a portion both at national council level and in individual tertiary institutions. Because I can tell you that for every academic program, students in every university and college are asked to annually pay subscription to National Council for Education, a body by law charged with ensuring that what is taught is up to date and is accredited. So National Council should, as of necessity, be following programs in all these institutions annually before even the conversation about the facts that they have lapsed takes place, because a fee is paid for that effect. So I agree in holding individuals culpable, accountable, that levels of culpability are established.
So where do Ugandans go from here, especially for those who have studied some of these courses that are supposedly expired now? Where do they go from here?
I think for me, the starting point is that the authorities in Uganda, all which is the citizens, to explain to all and sundry, all stakeholders, that these qualifications are not expired by any stretch of imagination. The whole idea of expired for me is most disturbing, and therefore, the authorities need to come out clearly and explain that there's nothing like an expiry. If National Council has not yet updated the program, the underlying factor is that probably they're content with what is being taught, and until it's been reviewed, it remains what is valid, because they have never issued a statement to anywhere to claim that the program so taught expired. As long as it's not been cancelled, then it is valid.
Attorney Matthias Mpuga is a teacher and the minority leader in the Ugandan Parliament. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Kenya, President William Ruto has warned all public officials that they will not be shielded from prosecution if they are caught in acts of corruption. In a warning letter, the president says his administration will not be tainted by fraud and malfeasance. Ruto called on all public officials to implement mechanisms to prevent wrongdoing. Local media reports say the president's warning appears to be due to public pressure to weed out corruption. Meanwhile, the Chinese embassy in Kenya has sharply denied media reports that hackers from China have attacked public institutions in Kenya, including the presidency. For the latest development on the fight against corruption and reports of Chinese spying, I reach attorney James Mwamu. He is a former president of the Law Society of Kenya.
I take that statement coming from the president a pinch of salt, because one, when the president was employing some of his cabinet ministers, the people who were in the previous administration, he employed some people who had court matters, people who are charged with corruption, you know, in various parastatals. Some even had murder cases, you know, pending against them. In a democratic society, in a civilized world, what the president should have done was to have allowed these officials to go through the trials, you know, let them be acquitted before they are appointed to their position. So I think that perhaps the president is just feeling the pressure from the public, but I don't think that he really wants to act against corruption. Because you see, if he really wanted to act against corruption, there are several things that he should have done.
What do you think he should have done? Or what should he do in addition to warning his officials? They will face the consequences if they are caught in corruption.
You know, apart from just relieving those guys of their duties, if they were caught in wrongdoing, we will have now seen the police, you know, having arrests and charging people. But nobody has been charged. Nobody has, no investigations going on. It is just by word of mouth. You know, if you are, you want to crack down on corruption, you know, in government offices, there are many things that you can do, you know. So I do not think that government is serious about fighting corruption.
But James, some of his supporters are saying that showing a clear sign that they would have to fend for themselves if they are caught in act of corruption is a sign in itself that the president is serious about the fight against corruption in Kenya.
You know, we have been in this country. We know we have been there when Moi was the president. We've been there when Kibaki was the president. We've been there when Uhuru was the president. And I can tell you that there is no seriousness about the intention to fight corruption. You know, there are many officials, you know, who have been mentioned in various scandals. What they do is just musical chair, remove them from one ministry to the other. When the courts are serious about convicting them, they will always find a way either to withdraw the case through the DPP or things like that. So I am, for now, I will adopt an approach of wait and see. But I don't see much coming out of that tough talking. You know, it is, I consider it is all talk. There will be no action. There are more other serious things, the more serious steps that should have been taken.
In another development, the Chinese embassy in Kenya has sharply denied reports that Chinese hackers targeted key state agencies, including the presidency himself. How are Kenyans reacting to this? And what has the government said so far about this?
One of the things that I've also done is that I have done a course of data protection and cyber security at Harvard University. So I know what these issues of cyber infiltration, hacking, and things like that. I know that big government, the American government, have been having a problem also, Chinese, Russians, you know, hacking into their system. I don't think that there is any Kenya who does not believe that the Chinese were involved in the hacking of our systems. But you know, the problem has been that we gave them a long leash into our systems. They have been there. You know, they have even constructed some of our very sensitive areas. And so I think that every Kenyan believes that there must have been hacking. And you know, the reason is because we owe them a lot of money. And they know that even if they do this kind of thing, there's very little that our government will do. They perhaps will just, you know, make some diplomatic statements, but nothing much comes out of that. And I think the Chinese also, in terms of foreign policy, are not very happy with the current government because, you know, they're probably showing that they're leaning more towards the West, the U.S. and the British government. That again, you know, has not pleased the Chinese. And, you know, part of the problem that we have now, the economy of Kenya, the reasons why sometimes the government is finding it difficult to raise money is because of these loans that we are paying the Chinese. And I think when sometimes they tell the Chinese that they don't have money, they may have gone an extra mile that they're going to find out if their money is in these ministries.
Attorney James Mwamu is a former president of the Law Society of Kenya. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Tell your friends about VOA Africa. Music, sports, the news.
Right now, it's time for music from African Collection.
If you understand me or not, misunderstand me or not, me, I'm okay. I'm okay. And if you think I'm wrong or not, long as it's what I want, me, I'm okay. I'm okay. Cause who are you to judge me like say you be holy pass? I did love my life, get my peace of mind, better try so fast. We all be sin as my party.
From Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothy. Stay tuned and don't change the dial.
You say you are the man, we go do you better. The king bomb of meta. Sexy jola jala din a little. I'ma how they feel your style. When you break your back for me. Free me, you know easy. This thing plenty, checking this. Plenty money for my baby. Make I know where you want see me, baby. They come easy. This thing plenty, checking this. Plenty money for my love. Sexy jala jala dida leta. Mama, how they feel your style when you break it down for me. I didn't know, baby, can you see? Many baba want joke, you know what it be. They want your bango on the low. But if you ready, one move, make a follow go. Anything what you do, mommy, me no go deny you.
Maybe no go further, I mean no go phone. Make a day anomaly, you know what I mean, yeah.
Free me, you know easy. This thing plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my piggy. Make I know where you want see me, baby. They come easy. This thing plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my duffel bag. Make I know where you want see me, baby. You say you want the man, we go do you better. But I want another dollar. The yoking bumper better. Sexy jala jala in a letter. I'm going to feel your style when you break it down.
It's DJ Stavro and you tuned into Nightline Africa on Voice of America. And you've just heard my brand new single titled Mtandazo. I hope you enjoy it.
Zaga that. Same time, body, time, time. It's your boy.
It's Kelly.
My baby, they confuse me, yo, with the bomb, bomb. But she get the guy where they send her money from London. She they see me like a Johnny, just come. Yeah. My monkey, they rockin', baboon, he just the chop. Me, I go chop body washing, as long as you give me my passion. Baby, make you know they rush me. I beg you, make you treat me with caution. Leg over. My baby, give me leg over. Hangover. Baby, she did give me hangover. Hey, leg over. Oh, no, me give me leg over. Hey, game over. She did come give me game over.
Hey, are they confused? Are they confused when you turn around? Baby, you they make her confuse. You do all I like it. A Cameroon, mess when rise the boy. And baby, make her confuse. Commando, you be commando. You they command the boy. You see overload. Yeah, yeah. I know fi stand alone. I must call my guy before rendezvous.
Yeah, I go trap body washing. As long as you give me my passion. Baby, make you know they rush me. I beg you, make you treat me with caution. Leg over, my baby give me leg over, hangover, baby she did give me hangover, hey, leg over, but no man give me leg over, hey, game over, she did come give me game over, ah.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C.
She get the guy where they send her money from London. She they see me like a Johnny, just come. My monkey, they rockin', baboon, he just the top. May I go trap body washing, as long as you give me my passion. Baby, make you know they rush me. I beg you, make you treat me with caution. Leg over. My baby, give me leg over. Hangover. Baby, she did give me hangover. Hey, leg over. Oh, no, man, give me leg over. Hey, game over. She did come give me game over.
I know if you stand alone, I must call my guy before rendezvous. I need that pill on the back of the street, it's so cold. You know if you carry the weight I put on my shoulder. Girl, I said I'd be home by the weekend, I know. But I gotta stay on the grind and stack up my dough. Many people wanna come try to waste time. They say the grass is greener on this side. My mama said the snakes are gonna still try. But that's okay, I got G's and they will ride. Oh yeah, you know, say over, stopping at my sickness. But granny, I'm just minding my business. That's why the earth and the sea is my witness.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, no amount of rain can stop the bitter leaf from being bitter. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.